Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. A decade and a half of war, in addition to all the other costs, brings with it some economic after effects. Another way to think about Afghanistan on the program today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 21st of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You can look at the cost of increasing the number of American troops in Afghanistan in a couple of ways, right? In lives, of course, the most basic and important measure. In dollars and cents, billions and billions of those dollars, the easiest way to add it all up, probably. But for a war that's been going on since 2001, there's a stability thing to talk about here as well, because despite, or maybe because of, 16 years of American and allied involvement, the Afghan economy is still in a good deal of trouble. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
When the U.S. first started pouring money and troops into Afghanistan back in 2001, the Afghan economy boomed. William Byrd is with the U.S. Institute of Peace.
Actually, between 2002 and 2012, the Afghan economy was growing at the fastest rate of almost any economy in the world.
But Byrd says the bottom dropped out of the Afghan economy in 2011 when the U.S. started a massive troop withdrawal. The average Afghan now only makes about $600 a year, according to the World Bank. Agriculture has always been a moneymaker. Illegally grown poppy for opium is the country's biggest cash crop. Afghanistan also has copper, iron, and rare minerals that could be mined. But they're not. Part of the problem? Corruption.
Everyone expects a bribe. Without the bribe, you don't get anything done.
That's Hossein Ashkari. He teaches business and international affairs at George Washington University. He says much of the money the U.S. has spent in Afghanistan has been siphoned off by corrupt officials. The Afghan government depends heavily on U.S. aid. Michael Semple is an Afghan expert and visiting professor at Queen's University Belfast. He spoke to me via Skype.
At the moment, Afghanistan cannot generate sufficient revenue legitimately to cover essential costs of the Afghan state.
Semple says the U.S. should try harder to stop the rampant corruption in Afghanistan that eats up so much of the revenue the government needs to stand on its own. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
As the president settles back into Washington today after a couple of weeks at his place up in New Jersey, and as Congress gears up to get back to work, the media balance of power in the Capitol has shifted a little bit. Steve Bannon, as you know, President Trump's now former chief strategist, is back at Breitbart as the conservative news site's executive chairman, promising to go to war, and that's Bannon's word, for Trump. Breitbart is said to be planning a big expansion into TV, possibly, as a counter to Fox News. So we asked Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson to have a look at what it might take for Breitbart to get into the television business.
The short answer is either a whole lot of money or not that much, depending on whether Breitbart goes for pricey cable TV or cheap and scrappy streaming video. The cable route would most likely involve buying an existing channel. Ken Doctor is a media analyst with Newsonomics.
There's a lot of money in the obtaining of the channel, of the promoting of the channel, of the building the channel behind it with talent in front of the camera and behind the camera.
When Al Jazeera launched its U.S. News Network in 2013, it paid a reported $500 million for Current TV's channel and its distribution deals.
It would take, clearly, I think, 3 to 5 years, probably optimistically, to turn a profit with a new cable news channel like that, even if you did everything right.
John Klein is the former president of CNN US and the co-founder of Tap Media, which builds online video channels. He says for Bannon and his deep-pocketed backers, profit motive might not be as important as political motives.
They want to have an even greater impact on their followers, and they want to motivate and activate their followers.
Klein says the better place for Breitbart to do that might be online.
When you go over the top and are delivering your video directly to consumers, you know their name, you know where they live, you know, their credit card information, and you can introduce them to one another.
And when you're building a movement, that's gold. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, a lull, a pause, if you will. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Trump declined to dissociate himself from his businesses when he took office. He gave operational control of the Trump Organization to his sons, yes, but he said he wasn't going to sell or put his assets into a blind trust. The law, it should be said, doesn't preclude conflicts of interest for the chief executive. Market forces, however, have other ideas. Since the event at Charlottesville a week or so ago and the president's comments thereafter, 15 charities have decided they are not interested in patronizing the president's Mar-a-Lago club down in Florida. That's out of about 21 groups said to have been thinking about having their big events there before Charlottesville. David Farenthold covers politics and the president's businesses for The Washington Post. David, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
The president is, of course, a businessman. How much is this going to cost him?
It's hard to tell, to give you a global number, because not all these charities say how much they pay Trump to host these events there. But if you look back at charity filings, you can kind of get a sense, and it's a significant amount of money. He's lost 11 galas or dinnertime events, and those, the charities can pay him between $100,000 up to $275,000 just for one night. So add those together, it's at least $1 million that he's in potential revenue that he's losing. In addition to that, there's four luncheons so far, and each one of those can be between $25,000 and
$50,000. What kind of groups are we talking about here? This is, just to remind people, this is sort of the highlight of the Palm Beach social season, right? These kinds of events.
Right. Palm Beach is an unusual place. I've learned a lot about it now covering this beat. For a few months, all these sort of wealthy folks move down to Palm Beach for the season, they call it. And every weekend there's some really big, lavish, over-the-top charity ball. That's sort of what you do in Palm Beach. And so Trump lost charities like the American Red Cross, the American Cancer Society, the Salvation Army, Susan G. Komen, that put on these really large, lavish banquets there. And many of them had been customers of Mar-a-Lago for a number of years, going back to 2008 or even before.
What do we know about the president's other hospitality businesses? You've written about his golf course out here in L.A., and I'm also thinking about his hotel, obviously, in Washington, D.C.
It's really a bifurcated answer. On the one hand, the Washington, D.C. Hotel, which is here in what President Trump calls the swamp, has made a lot of money catering to the swamp. There's a lot of foreign governments, conservative groups, state governors that want the president's ear that have paid for blocks of rooms at that hotel. But if you look at the broader universe of Trump's properties, he has a lot of places that cater to the very sort of elite, especially the coastal elite that Trump, the president, spends all his time bashing. So there's places like you mentioned the golf course. In L.A., it's lost a lot of money from charity outings. And then if you look at Trump Soho, a hotel in New York City, that's a place that used to depend a lot on corporations, big New York businesses that would rent out the ballrooms to have meetings and other stuff like that. There's been a lot of reports by WNYC, the radio station in New York, that they've lost a ton of that business and have even had to consider layoffs. And they've canceled the turndown service as a result of that.
Oh, geez.
So if you lose the turndown service, it's all downhill.
Then you know it's rough, right? A contextualizing word here for a second. So we've talked about the social upper strata disassociating themselves from Trump. Last week we had, of course, big American businesses and corporations vocally dissociating themselves from the president. What does sort of the short-term future hold as the Charlottesville events still ripper through the society?
It's been a very interesting turning point. We saw President Trump in the context of the campaign make a lot of statements both live, that, you know, his comments about Mexican immigrants at his announcement speech and also on tape in the Access Hollywood tape. There were lots of things that happened in the campaign where you thought, wow, people are going to break with him. And winning sort of, I think, kind of cleared the slate. And it's been interesting to me to see that Charlottesville, his comments about there being, quote, very fine people, unquote, among the folks marching to preserve the Robert E. Lee statue, those comments seem to have really driven a wedge between Trump and the businesses that patronize his businesses and also the businesses whose political support he needs. I think what's flipped is that before Charlottesville, if you were connected to Trump through an advisory board or through a gala at Mar-a-Lago, pulling that connection would seem like a political decision. Now, in some cases, it seems like people are treating the decision to stay connected to Trump through an advisory board, through a gala, through some business connection. The decision to stay with Trump after Charlottesville, that looks like a political decision. And I think that's changed a lot of calculus for people, and it's really affected the business of the Trump Organization.
David Farenthold at The Washington Post. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The 10-day Sturgis Motorcycle Rally, largest of its kind in the world, wrapped up in South Dakota earlier this month with almost 15% more bikers having rolled through the small town in the Black Hills of South Dakota than did last year. Boom time for bikes, one might assume. But consider this. Americans have actually been buying fewer motorcycles since the recession. Bikes are in that discretionary income category, of course. And different problem, close to half of motorcycle riders are now north of 50 years old. So manufacturers like Harley-Davidson are trying to edge into that younger demographic. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one.
At Bartell's Harley-Davidson in the Southern California beach town of Marina del Rey, customers stroll around looking at cruisers, those motorcycles you ride with your feet out in front and your hands up high. Plenty of tattoos and leather jackets on this middle-aged set. Younger folks, not many around. Ron Bartels runs the place. He says sales were off the charts 10 years back. Now?
Definitely is less people buying motorcycles. Our future goal is to get more butts on seats.
According to the Motorcycle Industry Council, last year, U.S. customers rolled off with 371,403 new bikes, roughly half as many as a decade ago. At Harley, the latest quarterly earnings show U.S. sales were down more than 4% compared to the same period last year, almost 10% in Asia. Like other manufacturers, Harley's got an age problem, says Gleb Mitko, an analyst with the business research company the Fredonia Group.
A lot of the brands like Harley-Davidson are iconic, and you have to pay a premium for that. And for a lot of the younger riders, their stagnant wages and issues with student debt have made it harder to afford a motorcycle that often can cost more than $25,000.
To attract younger riders, bike makers have been offering slimmer, more streamlined models, which are cheaper. Young people tend to go after the hipper look, a Triumph, say, or the new Honda Rebel. That's one reason Harley's introduced what it's calling the Street line of bikes. They don't look like traditional Harleys. They're shorter and put riders lower to the ground. And on this one, you sit leaning forward, not with a straight back like a traditional cruiser. These bikes also don't sound much like Harleys. This is a stock Harley Sportster. Notice that classic growl, what riders call the potato-potato coming out of the exhaust. Now listen to the Street 750. That sound, it's not going to turn any heads as you ride by. It's a comfortable ride, though, and fits nicely with what younger people are buying. Bikes more suitable for commuting that cost less than $7,000. Harley also offers classes for first-time riders, using the Street Series to teach. John Sosby runs the training class at Bartels.
It's a little heavier than some of the training bikes you'll see on other sites, but it carries that weight very low. And it's actually easy to manage, and it gives them a more realistic feeling of what they may encounter when they do get that full-size Harley.
That's the goal. Get someone on a smaller bike and eventually sell them on a souped-up $25,000 cruiser. Brian Eastless is 24 and rode a motorcycle for the first time in class today. He says few of his contemporaries go after Harleys.
My younger friends actually have, you know, sports bikes, and I'm leaning more towards Harley just for the heritage and, you know, the old school vibe of it.
But he's also realistic about how much he can spend on his first bike. So if he sticks with the brand, he's looking at getting a used Harley. The company says it wants to attract 2 million new U.S. riders over the next 10 years. To do that, it's aiming to introduce 100 new motorcycle models, including an electric bike. Gleb Mitko at the Fredonia Group thinks electric is the future of motorcycles.
A lot of companies are investing heavily in research and development, and many of these are being widely used in Asia. So I foresee their use increasing in the U.S. over time as well.
Imagine that, an electric Harley. Well, if you can't get young people to hop on a decked-out cruiser for a weekend ride, maybe you can sell them on the idea of how great that selfie's going to look when they're revving up that electric motorbike. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And the stranger up in New York was getting all her texts and phone calls.
What could possibly go wrong? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 29 points today, about a 10th percent, 21,703. The NASDAQ down 3. We'll call that unchanged, 62.13. S&P 500 up 2, 10th percent, kind of ended at 24.28. We looked at what it takes to break into television with the possibility that Breitbart might be going there. Fox News owner 21st Century Fox clicked up 4-tenths percent today. Comcast boosted nearly 7-tenths percent. The sun sets at last on the 2017 eclipse. See what we did there? Sun sets. It presented oh so many money-making opportunities. Royal Caribbean that offered an eclipse cruise sailed up 9-tenths percent. Alaska Airlines had an eclipse flight, landed down about a half percent. Billboard reports a 500% rise in digital sales of the song Total Eclipse of the Heart. Leading up to that event, Apple that runs iTunes off by a 10th percent today. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal with the news about businesses and certain social strata pulling back from their interactions with President Trump. We're going to go back to an early win he had, the Carrier Furnace and Air Conditioning factory in Indianapolis, Indiana, and the deal Trump brokered to keep that plant and its jobs in this country. Turns out, in July, on the six-month anniversary of Inauguration Day, Carrier started the first round of layoffs in a plan to cut 632 of those formerly saved jobs by the end of this year. James Briggs writes for the Indianapolis Star. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
First of all, let me ask you a sort of a zeitgeisty question. What's the economic mood out there?
You know, overall, it's pretty good. The unemployment rate in Indiana is at 3.1%. That's real close to an all-time low. There are a lot of jobs available right now, particularly in the logistics and technology sectors. So for most people looking for work in Indiana right now, there are jobs out there.
The reason we called you, and frankly, the reason that probably a lot of people in a national sense are aware of Indianapolis and employment, is the deal that Carrier made with the state of Indiana, then Governor Pence, and the president elect back right after the election, saving some number of jobs. What's the latest update on that?
Yeah, so what got headlines at the time, of course, was Trump's deal that saved the Carrier factory. But what's happened since then, as expected, has been some layoffs. Carrier last month laid off 338 people. It happened to be on the six-month anniversary of Trump's presidency. And there are about 300 more layoffs expected at Carrier's Indianapolis factory by the end of the year.
It's funny you said as expected, as in everybody knew this was coming no matter what the deal was.
Carrier's part of the deal was to keep 1,069 jobs for 10 years. But Carrier employed quite a few more people than that. So the company had expected all along to lay off people. And now that's playing out right now, not only in Indianapolis, but also there's a plant in Huntington where Carrier's laying off another 700 people.
And then there's also another factory, another company called Rexnord nearby, right? That's also, it's not closing, but outsourcing a bunch of jobs.
That factory actually is closing, and they're in the process of winding that one down right now in Indianapolis. So, yeah, and those two plants, Rexnord and Carrier, are about a mile away from each other in Indianapolis.
And yet you say the economic mood is pretty good, and unemployment is at, what'd you say, 3.1%?
3.1% in Indiana, and the lowest it's ever been was 2.9%. So, yeah, overall, the mood is good here.
How is that happening? Where are the jobs? Who's getting hired?
Perhaps unexpectedly, if you look just at last month, Indiana actually added 1,000 manufacturing jobs. It really depends on where you are, of course, in the state. For instance, there's a town in northern Indiana called Elkhart, where most of America's RVs are made. And in that town, there just aren't enough people to fill all the manufacturing jobs that have opened up to fuel that RV industry.
Yeah. One last thing about Carrier. When you covered this most recent announcement back a month or so ago, you quoted an academic and he said, you know, Carrier deserves some praise for keeping this factory open as long as it did, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. Well, even if you look at the deal that was reached with Trump and Pence and Carrier late last year, Carrier got $7 million in state incentives. But if Carrier had actually moved all of those jobs to Mexico, it would have saved far more money than that. I think it reached this deal more for political reasons than for bottom line reasons. But it's found ways to keep making that factory more efficient, and it's trying to do so now in the wake of that deal that it reached last year.
Right. James Briggs at the Indianapolis Star. James, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you. Meow.
Just as we in the American credit card using economy start to get a grip on security, we've got chips in our cards now, right? Well behind the rest of the world, to be sure, and we're still without pins, so you know there's that. But just as we begin to get our credit card security act together, the bad guys are moving on. Your phone number is now what identity thieves want as they come up with ever more creative ways to steal not just your money, but to take over your financial accounts entirely. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
The Bennetts, Tiffany and Kevin, live near Columbia, South Carolina. And one day, Tiffany got an email from her phone company saying the password on their joint account had been changed.
But I actually didn't think anything of it because he and I share an account and we do that sometimes. And I meant to check with Kevin to see if he had done it, and it slipped my mind.
After all, this was her cell phone, not like it was her credit card or something.
When I really knew something was wrong and put everything together was a couple hours later when all of a sudden my texting wouldn't work.
Thieves had somehow gotten the username and password the Bennetts used to access their account with their phone company. They may have hacked the phone company or they may have hacked a different website where the Bennetts used the same username and password. However they got the information, the thieves logged in, changed the password, and transferred Tiffany Bennett's phone number to a new phone, locking her out.
Her phone number still worked. It just rang on the phone that they had. And the stranger up in New York was getting all her texts and phone calls. And
Tiffany's husband, Kevin.
And then that's what they used to enroll in Apple Pay using one of our credit card accounts that they also had access to.
Crooks used the phone number to impersonate the Bennetts with their credit card company. When the credit card company texted to say, is everything okay? The thief could just say, yep, sure is. The crooks ended up purchasing hundreds of dollars worth of stuff.
Mobile phone account hijacking doubled in 2016.
Mike Bremer is vice president of consumer protection at Experian. Hacking phones makes it easier for a fraudster to then hack into a bank account or credit card. It's a type of fraud called account takeover, and cell phones are often the key.
In 2016, account takeover fraud was about $2.3 billion worldwide, but it was up 61%.
Thieves are now taking over all kinds of accounts, not just phone lines, and locking people out. Ken Miser is with ID Analytics.
Card, auto, demand deposit accounts, checking accounts, and 401k accounts.
Yes, even 401k accounts. There are a couple reasons why account takeover fraud of all different kinds is blowing up. Greg Goff is with LifeLock, which, by the way, provides underwriting support for Marketplace.
With the advent of the chip being placed in credit cards, it has lowered the value of stealing a credit card number. They're moving on to other more lucrative types of fraud.
When someone takes over your account, they can change your security questions and your passwords. The nasty part about it is that when you call up to try and get your account back, you sound like the shady one. You don't know your new password, your security question. You sometimes don't have access to your phone. Tiffany Bennett.
It was a logistical nightmare just with all of our different accounts and making sure that they were protected and explaining about the phone number because they would want to call the phone number to verify. And it was just a mess.
The Bennetts were eventually able to get their phone back and the fraudulent charges removed. Experts say there are a few things you can do to limit the damage and risk of account takeover. First, do not use the same password for multiple accounts, including your phone. LifeLock's Greg Goff.
Identity thieves buy thousands of hacked usernames and passwords, and then they just run bots to see where that login succeeds.
Other options to protect yourself include getting a separate low-limit credit card for online shopping, don't use public Wi-Fi to check sensitive accounts, and do use two-factor authentication. But what the experts come back to again and again is do not reuse passwords. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, an update not on the news of today, nor of tomorrow, but of rather mid-October-ish. That's the time frame by which Congress and the president will have to agree to raise the debt limit lest the government run out of cash to pay our bills. A debt limit increase is always, and I mean always a deeply politicized act. But at an event today with Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, basically, yeah, I got this.
There is zero chance, no chance, we won't raise the debt ceiling. No chance. America's not going to default, and we'll get the job done in conjunction with the Secretary of the Treasury.
You heard it here first, folks, on CNBC, actually, which is where we got that tape. But do not take this to mean, repeat, do not take this to mean that a debt limit increase is not going to be politicized. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. The Dow up 29 points today, about a tenth percent, 21,703. The NASDAQ off three, basically unchanged. S&P 500 up 2 points, about a tenth percent. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.